Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Adam, on our show today, we get to talk with Dr. Matthew Lawn, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the University of North Carolina, about drugs for little children. What is safe? Should be an interesting conversation.
You know, Christy, both of us have had little children, and I know both of us have probably had times in which our little children were getting medications, and we give prescriptions to little children. It's a scary area.
It is, and important for parents to listen in, grandparents to listen in, and find out what we know and what we don't know about medications for little children.
Maybe a little surprising. Speaking of surprising, we have some surprising research that matters today, I think, about the kind of studies that tout cancer drugs and cancer achievements. Do they tell us the full story?
And about learning a second language might slow the brain's decline.
About what is one of the most commonly abused drugs that lands people in the emergency room.
And about a link between teacher depression and preschoolers' behavior.
Well, let's talk about the very first research that matters, Christy, about cancer ads, or specifically in this case, advertisement for cancer centers. And we can imagine that lots of cancer centers out there want to tout their rankings or want to tout their achievements, and they're going to want to probably talk about all the good things that they can do. Is that what you think?
Yeah. And, you know, cancer is very scary, and we've had such an increase for direct-to-consumer ads on television, on the radio. So this was a study that was published in the Annals of Internal Medicine where they looked at 409 different unique TV and magazine advertisements on the top media markets to find out what is being used and what is not being said about these medications.
In what's called a content analysis, where they look to see in these advertisements what's really being discussed and in some cases what's not being discussed. And what they found was being discussed is that this is the kind of – these ads are really touching and pulling at our heartstrings, so to speak, that 85% made an emotional appeal to the people reading them, that 61% talked about the good things that can happen, advanced improvement in technology.
Hope, cure for
and
cancer.
And even scaring sometimes the fear from not getting treatment in a third of the time.
And they found out, notably, that what was missing from these ads were information about the risks or about any scientific benefits, and only 5% mentioned the cost of treatment, and less than 2% disclosed the risks of the cancer treatment. So what this is really saying to me is that, you know, notably, they're trying to sell their products, but they're doing so with a very emotional approach and not mentioning some of the realities about the cost and the risk. And I think people should be aware of that.
In addition to which, occasionally some of this information actually could violate Federal Trade Commission reporting requirements that says what happens to a typical patient. And so I think what we're going to see is more really monitoring of the situation. And also hopefully our listeners, we can look past some of the emotional heartstrings and say, hey, let's tell us about what are the risks and what are the costs. I think important questions.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about learning a second language. Do you know a second language?
You're not talking about Pig Latin here, are you? I hey, one, ikte, atinle. Not that kind of. Well, I can speak several languages, but whether I can do it fluently or understand them is different. I wish I had studied more language, but maybe it's not too late for me.
I know, maybe it's not.
What about you?
Well, I can speak a little bit of Spanish. I understand more than I speak. My children, thankfully, are bilingual. But anyway, this is good news about learning a second language. A study published by the Annals of Neurology, which is a study of your brain and how it works in your nerves, showing that picking up a new language even later in life can have good benefits for your aging brain.
Yeah, this was at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. I'd love to go there and talk with them about this research.
I think we should. We need a trip.
They studied 850 people who first took an intelligence test in 1947 when they were very, very young. And they followed this group up when they're in their 70s. And they looked at a total of 262 of these people who reported having learned at least another language other than English. And when they learned this language, of course, many of them learned it when they were young, but some of them learned it much later in life. And then what was the impact of learning this second language? Did it seem to have some slowing of cognitive decline or Alzheimer-type symptoms?
Yeah, they gave the participants all these different tests, including their verbal reasoning, their vocabulary, how well they read, their fluency with words, their ability to process information quickly, and found that the people who had learned another language any time in their life, enough to speak some sentences, performed much better than expected from their base compared with their baseline ability back when they were 10 or 11 years old, and particularly in the areas of reading and in general intelligence.
I think this is really fascinating. It kind of makes me want to say, okay, it's not too late, Adam. You can go learn another language, and there's probably really good benefits. I think this is wonderful. I'll probably start recommending it because I don't think there's much of a downside.
Well, I did have questions of maybe the people who learn the language are just have something about their brains that make it easier to learn a language, so they stick with it. So I had some questions about it, but, you know, there's really not a lot of downside in trying, so I'm gonna try to get back to it.
Well, let's talk about our very next research that matters, Christy, which is if you'd asked me what was probably one of the most commonly abused drugs going to the emergency room, I might have gotten it, but
I would have said Percocet.
I would have said, yeah, the oxycodone, those pain medications. This might have been up there, and it is a cause of concern, and it's the medication called Xanax or Alprazolam.
And apparently, the number of emergency department visits related to abuse of this medication, Alprazolam or Xanax, climbed from more than 57,000 in 2005 to nearly 124,000 in the year 2011.
And this is research that comes from what's called SAMHSA, or the Substance Use Mental Health Services Administration's 2011 Drug Abuse Warning Network, and really kind of shows the highlight of both use of the medication, particularly in elderly people, but also those who are also taking these pain medications or using alcohol, and the abuse of the medication, which happens way too easily and lands people in the emergency room, or people even misusing something that wasn't even meant for them and using it from someone else.
Yeah, people are mixing drugs. I mean, all those pain medicines that we mentioned earlier are so common. And if you combine the opioid painkillers and the sedatives, we hear on TV certain people who pass away and die from overdose of these medications. So if you are prescribed a sedative or one of those pain medicines that's really strong, it's advisable to lock them up while you're using them. If you're done using them, to throw them away, and to be just very cautious about not letting other people take your medications and being careful not to mix drugs that's not like really gone over carefully with your physician.
If it doesn't seem right, it probably isn't.
That's right.
Speaking of which, doesn't seem right. This last research that mattered, Christie's. It doesn't seem right, but I was really surprised, which it does make sense that if the teacher in the classroom is depressed, it can't be good for the students, but I don't think I'd ever thought about why wouldn't teachers in classroom be depressed, because depression is very common.
Well, and interesting that the researchers in this study found that the students, these are preschool students, of teachers who were battling depression acted out more or had poorer behavior than the preschoolers taught by other teachers who weren't depressed, which really highlights that link between the child's health and the caregiver's health as you think about this. And maybe the depressed teachers were more likely to, maybe they weren't paying as much attention, or maybe the preschoolers were feeding or sort of like reacting to a disconnect in their depressed teacher. I don't know.
Yeah, this was research in the Journal of Consulting and Clinical Psychology in 15 U.S. cities with 761 families and teachers. And certainly there is this, I think, data now that suggests that we do have to, we look at if you had a pilot that was depressed, what the impact of flying a plane. Certainly, I think providers or physicians that are depressed, that has an impact. Anyone who's dealing and going through a significant emotional illness like depression is going to impact the environment that they're in. And our youngest kids, if they're acting out more, aggression, anger, lack of control, and it is linked in part due to what's happening in the classroom, it's something that all parents, I think, and the school system should be aware of.
Well, and another cry to take care of our teachers and provide support and resources for them.
Maybe they're not getting paid enough.
That's right. Maybe they're definitely not getting paid enough. Well, that's all we have. That's a whole nother topic. But we've had a chance to talk about a link between depression and teachers and behavior of preschoolers.
And more research that needs to be happened there about emergency room visits tied to sedatives. We really need to do a much better job.
About learning a second language at any age, not too late for us, might slow the brain's decline.
And finally, about the advertisements for cancer centers. Really need to have the full range of experience, not just all positives.
Well, that concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. Adam and I are going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Matthew Lawn, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the University of North Carolina, about drugs for little children. What is safe? You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with Dr. Matthew Lawn, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the University of North Carolina, about drugs for little children. What is safe?
Thanks so much for being with us, Dr. Lawn.
Thanks for having me.
You know, help us introduce you to our listeners. Tell us what it was that drew you to the field of pediatrics and particularly to the very, very young.
Sure. So I am a neonatologist, which is a doctor that takes care of babies, usually in the intensive care unit. And I got here by doing 4 years of medical school and then a 3-year pediatric residency actually here at the University of North Carolina. And while I was doing that residency, I recognized that babies were really what drew me or interested me the most because, first of all, they're the most vulnerable of all of our patients, and they tend to do really well if we take care of them. And if we do our job right, then they have a lifetime of health to enjoy.
Well, you know, I think when people think about drugs in children, I think inherently you talk about the trust that as a doctor you must have to take care of them. But I think parents just inherently trust physicians that they're picking drugs that are safe. How did you get interested in drugs and safety with children?
Right. That's a great question. So we know that when we prescribe a drug to a child that about 60 to 70% of the time there is no FDA labeling.
And Food and Drug Administration.
That's right, Food and Drug Administration. And that is the U.S.
Seal of approval?
Seal of approval, so to speak. That's right. They're the folks who make sure, they're charged with making sure that drugs are safe and effective. And they usually work with pharmaceutical companies in order to do that. Most drugs are marketed towards adults, and so therefore they tend to drift down into pediatrics thereafter. Not always, but most of the time. And so usually drugs, when we use them, are off-label, meaning that they're the wrong dose or they're used for a different indication than what's used in adults.
And is that true? Are we talking about medications that parents might give their children, might give their newborns, as well as the medications that you're using in the intensive care unit, or are those two separate categories in your mind?
Those are really separate issues. One, you're talking about over-the-counter medications. Those are usually generally regarded as safe. They've gone through rigorous evaluations to make sure that they're safe. And so if folks use those medications the way that the label says, then they're generally safe. What we're talking about, or what I'm talking about, is more has to do with either in the hospital use or those that are prescribed by a family physician or a pediatrician taking care of an infant or child.
So let's set a stage here. I have a child that's coming in that has an infection and a pneumonia, for instance. And I would typically perhaps have a drug that I would use for an adult that would be 250 milligrams, let's say. And for the child who maybe weighs 15 pounds and the adult weighed 300 pounds, can I just divide that by 20 and give 12 and a half milligrams? That's not the way it works?
That's not the way it works, unfortunately.
Well, tell us why not.
Sure.
What kind of problems are you looking at?
Right. So that's a good example. In fact, we had a case a few years ago about a baby who was born with early and got a fungal infection on her back. And it got all over her back. And we got a call from the local neonatologist saying, you know, there's this dose of this medicine, and I don't know what dose to use. And should I take the dose that's normally used in adults and divide it so that the baby gets it per pound, or what we use is per kilogram? And we had some inside information because we'd actually done the study in babies, and it was not public knowledge yet. And we knew that dose that this neonatologist was going to use was wrong. It was too low. And so we recommended using a higher dose, and sure enough, the baby got better, and it was awesome. And that's what drives our research and our group.
And so considering the paucity or the lack of research out there that really guides physicians in your field of how to dose medicines for babies, how do people learn it? Is that just something you learn in fellowship based on what the people before you did, or are people sort of making it up?
They're doing the best they can with the knowledge that we have. And so, you know, it starts with adults and then moves down into children and then infants. And most people get their drug dosing information from dosing handbooks. Most of the handbooks get their information from the FDA label. Again, that's the Food and Drug Administration. There are labels that are out there at the FDA, which usually demonstrates what the dose is, what the problems are, what the side effects are. And so as long as the information gets into the FDA label, then it will eventually end up in the hands of physicians. However, let me ask you all a question now. Have you ever read an FDA label?
Well, I know that when we give our medications to patients, that the labels are oftentimes very, very long and large, and then there are these black box labels.
That's correct.
And the black box labels we see a lot, which are those things.
Read those.
This drug, if taken, can cause really bad things.
That's right. Well, most physicians, in fact, nearly all pediatricians, none of them have ever read an FDA label. And that's because they're very hard to read. They're tiny print, they're long, they're hard to read, they're in language that isn't clear, they're in different organization depending on what year that they were originally came out. So they're challenging to read sometimes. And so that's why most physicians go to these drug handbooks. And so the drug handbooks use the FDA label, and then they use information from the medical literature in order to get the right dose, or what they think is the right dose.
And so I'm wondering if our listeners who may have babies or may have children in the hospital, should people be worried about this?
Well, that's a good question. I think in general we generally give the right dose most of the time. However, the more we learn, the more we realize that we probably aren't quite right. So what we're doing is really optimizing the dose. And so most of the time,
what does that mean?
It means getting the right dose to the right patient at the right time. So there are very small babies that we take care of sometimes, very small, less than a pound, sometimes even less than that, who are very vulnerable. And we like to make sure that they're exposed to the right dose. And so for those babies in particular, we try and get the dose right.
I know when we come back from a break, we're gonna talk about your research and what you found, but I'm just kind of curious. It seems like this is the area where mistakes could really happen. Tell us about what are the common mistakes that actually happen out there, either because there's not enough research or because it's just too easy to make a mistake. What are we looking at?
So usually in the field that we're talking about, it's underexposure, meaning that the babies metabolize medicines very different than adults. And so if you take that adult dose and divide it by the weight of the baby, or by the weight of the adults, and give it to the baby, then generally that results in an exposure that's too low. And so if you have an infection and the exposure is too low, then they can get really sick.
And what about giving too much? Because I think that's what many parents would be really worried about. They'd say, you know, if you give too little, just give it to them a little longer, a little more frequently, they'll be okay, which may will come back and challenge that assumption. But I think what people would be really worried about is you give them too much and they lose their hearing and they use
some bad toxicity or some toxic thing.
Does that not happen very often?
No, it does. Not often, but it does happen. And you're exactly right in that higher doses are usually linked to adverse effects or side effects. And those are those things, those black box warnings and those problems that are listed in the FDA label are more likely to happen when they're overexposed or the dose is too high.
And so how do we stop that from occurring?
Well, what we do is we take the drug and we actually study it to make sure that we know that we've got the right dose. So it's not too high and not too low.
Well, we are going to need to take a short break, but this is a fascinating conversation, and I hope that we'll gain some clarity about what you're doing to research this and really what the next steps are to make a difference for our most vulnerable babies when they're sick.
We'll take a short break, but then we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Matthew Long, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the University of North Carolina, about drugs for little children. What is safe? We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Matthew Long, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the University of North Carolina, about drugs for little children. What is safe? Right before the break, Dr. Long, you were talking about kind of the common errors of giving too little medication and sometimes giving too much. But I think the biggest problem perhaps is not that the drug itself is given in the wrong doses, but other errors occur with the administration. Is that right?
And, absolutely.
And how often does this occur? Because we hear about drug errors being a major cause of hurting people.
Absolutely. And Adam, you're absolutely correct in that medication errors are a major source of morbidity and problems in hospitals and in pharmacies and in the outpatient world. And the problem usually is the wrong medicine is given to the wrong patient.
Like what? Give us an example of what could happen.
So let's say I go to my physician as an adult and I get a prescription for an antibiotic. You mentioned an antibiotic earlier that I had a cough and they did a chest x-ray and I have pneumonia. And I go pick it up and I'm supposed to get amoxicillin. And then they give me a different medication instead, like aminophylline. So AMI, it looks the same, sounds the same. I'm not even sure I know the difference. But I go and I start taking this aminophylline, which has nothing to do with amoxicillin, and I get worse and sick and end up in the hospital. So that's unfortunately a very common mistake in which the wrong medicine was given to the wrong patient.
And is that more common with children because you've got another advocate involved or because it is more complicated in the hospital?
Well, in the hospital, it is very complicated because there's usually a physician or a provider that's writing an order that goes usually these days into a computer system. So if they use the wrong dose, because usually they have to know the weight of the child, so they could have that's an error right there. It has to go down to the pharmacy where the pharmacist makes up the medication. They have to receive that order and then make the medication up, particularly if it's intravenous, which means going into the veins or through an IV. And so it has to be made correctly, and then it has to come up to the correct unit or the correct floor, the correct ward, wherever the child is. And then the nurse or whoever's on the floor has to check the medication and make sure it's going to the right patient. So there are many, many steps that go from between ordering the medicine and the patient actually receiving the medicine where there can be problems.
So if you had a child that weighed 1.7 kilograms, that would be not unusual for you in the neonatal ICU.
That's right.
Which is, about 4 pounds,
that's
possibly,
right,
or something, maybe even less than that, maybe 0.7 kilograms. And someone writes in their 1.7 by accident or writes in the pounds and then someone thinks it's the kilograms. Are these errors likely to be caught? Because it seems like making an error is relatively easy. catching the error? Or what else do we do to stop this?
Right. That's a great question. So there are many, many redundant systems in place in order to try to optimize or make sure that the right drug gets to the right patient with the right dose. And so one of the things is sort of checks in the computer, in that if you have a baby, the computer knows that somebody's put in the birth weight, which was, you know, you said 0.7 kilograms, the computer knows that. And if you put in 1.7 by accident or 700 by accident, because you could switch it by accident and do grams, that's a 100-fold difference in drug, which would be a big difference, then the computer usually will flag it and say, hey, did you really mean 0.7 or 700? I think it's supposed to be 0.7 instead, and that way it flags it.
Well, and that part hopefully will be reassuring for our listeners. There are, the computer checks it, the pharmacy checks it, then the nursery checks it. There are multiple checks in the process, which help us catch those errors before they actually cause a problem to our patients. But what you're doing is research, getting back to our conversation about trying to understand what doses and what medications are safe for these little vulnerable babies. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing to improve this field.
Sure. So my overall research goal is to improve the public health of children, period. And the way that we do that through our research group is to make sure that the drugs that are generally already being used are the right doses for kids. And so I'm part of a group that does research not just in neonates or in infants, premature infants, but also in children. And so what we do, it's called the Pediatric Trials Network. And for those of you that have computers, you can go look it up online at pediatrictrials.org. It's all right there, a description of all the studies that we do.
And we'll put a link on that on our website.
Great. And we're funded by the government, U.S. government, to do exactly what I've mentioned all along, which is to take these drugs that are off patent, meaning that pharmaceutical companies no longer hold the patent. These are generic drugs and are off-label use, so that the FDA label does not mention either the dose or the reason, the indication for using the medication. And we take those gaps and those knowledge gaps and try and figure out what the right dose or what the right indication is.
So if you're a parent and out in the audience, we have lots of parents out there.
Christy
and I are parents. We're not grandparents yet. Grandparents out in the audience. What should they be doing in network? Or, I mean, obviously supporting the research that you're doing is an important piece that the public is doing. But there are other things that the public should be advocating for, either with the Food and Drug Administration, with pharmaceutical makers. What are some of the touch points that we really need to start doing better?
Well, I think that the best way is to for parents is actually to participate if they have the opportunity, because one of the hard things to do for pediatric trials is getting parents to consent to the studies. It's very challenging, and as a parent myself, I recognize how challenging it is to consent to some of these research studies, but I would strongly encourage them to participate or think about participating at least if they have the opportunity to do so.
And I could see how a parent, if you say, I'm going to test a drug on your child, would be resistant to that. I don't want to do experiments on my baby. But yet, by not participating, those same medications are being used. You just don't know that it's sort of an experiment.
Right, you're absolutely right. So, it's if I chose to use a new drug or a drug for a different indication and just order it for my patients, I can do that on my own as a physician. However, if I wanted to actually study it to see if it's the right medication and maybe collect some blood to make sure that it's the right, the levels were right, I have to get informed consent, and that's just one of the quirks of the U.S. research infrastructure or the U.S. research system.
When it sounds scarier to the parents,
absolutely,
I think, versus the confident doctor.
That's right. That's right. I'm evidently supposed to know that what the right dose is without actually having the knowledge behind it.
Well, I know that we're excited that you're trying to work on improved drug labeling, trying to make these drugs safer. You've done some research with BPD.
That's right.
Tell us a little bit about that, and how did your work lead to the development of a new tool to predict infants' risk? And is this going to help change the face of some of the problems we're seeing in neonatal medicine?
Well, I hope so. So one of the things that I've done in my, as well as drug studies, is actually epidemiology, or sort of studying different diseases in a population. And one of the things that we did was to use a tool that's online also, neonatal.rti.org. It's freely available for parents and providers to use. It's the BPD estimator, the NICHD, which is the funding agency for kids.
For child health development?
Child health and human development. There's an extra H in there that they don't put on there.
And what's the BPD?
BPD is bronchopulmonary dysplasia. So that's a disorder of prematurity that has to do with lung disease. It's when babies receive a prolonged period of oxygen or mechanical ventilation. It's unique to premature infants. And what we were able to do is to figure out by postnatal day what the baby's risk of it was, which I know actually is already being used in drug studies to try and prevent that terrible disorder.
That is fantastic. Well, we will be sure to put that up on our blog. Repeat those two websites you've sent our listeners to already.
Sure. So for drug studies, it's pediatrictrials.org. And for the BPD estimator, it is neonatal.rti.org. And it's under tools.
Well, that's wonderful.
Well, thank you, Dr. Matt Long,
for
being with
us
and for having this conversation and the work you're doing for our most vulnerable. We've been talking with Dr. Matthew Long, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at UNC, about drugs for little children. What is safe? Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
And if you have an issue you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, please send it to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, to read us our very first House Call today about measles.
I've heard on the news since the measles outbreak that anyone going out of the country needs to have a measles vaccine. My fiancé and I are traveling to the Dominican Republic for our honeymoon. Do we really need to get this?
You know, the tricky thing is, as you're an adult, it's hard to have those records of what you've had as a child. And it's hard for me to know how old you are and what kinds of shots you had. But right now, people get their measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine before they go to school with a booster. And so some people need titers, or where you can get a blood test and see if it's still effective in your body. But for people who've had their vaccines, usually you're protected.
And depending, again, just as Christy has said, on your age, you should have gotten. If you got two shots when you were younger, you are almost certainly protected, though not always. And we've had some cases recently where even someone going to medical school, their titer wasn't what it should be despite getting it. So if you wanted to be perfectly safe, you could certainly get a titer drawn, a blood test drawn, and see if you actually have the antibodies that say that you're protected. Certainly if you only had one measles shot or you've never been vaccinated, then you're at high risk. And boy, we've seen an explosion in measles this year. We were down to 30 cases a decade ago, Christy, a year, and we're over 400 cases in this year alone.
I know. It's really hard. There's so much concern about vaccines, and now because there are more people not getting their vaccines or giving them to children, we're having more outbreaks of illness. And so if you are on the fence about getting your vaccines, we just want to encourage you to read more. There's information on the CDC website, and we can post that to our blog that has questions for parents and questions if you're concerned about vaccines. But do vaccinate your children, and if you haven't had your MMR vaccine, go get one.
I can subscribe to that. Erica, what's our very next house call?
My sister is 32 years old and has Down syndrome. She is overweight and knows she needs to lose the extra weight, but she's been unsuccessful. Why are children with Down syndrome overweight? Is there any research on this topic?
That is
good question.
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's something that we have observed that that people with Down syndrome, and it's not just children, they're growing with better health care, growing into adults, into adulthood with that are more likely to have obesity and more likely to be overweight than people without Down syndrome.
And there could be lots of reasons behind this. It may have something to do with hormones, and so we know that there's a higher incidence, a higher rate of low thyroid, or called hypothyroidism, in children and adults with Down syndrome. The metabolism may be less. Certain behaviors associated with eating may be higher. So lots of different factors, but you're right. It's about 2 to 3 times higher than the general population levels of obesity in Down syndrome's children and adults.
And I would encourage you to continue to support your sister, try to go and exercise with her, try to work on family, you know, eating habits together so that you can together get more healthy.
And please bring it to your doctor's attention because, you know, I think sometimes, maybe even too often, maybe we don't recognize this as much. Maybe we are part of the problem, but we could be part of the solution here. And let's work together here, your sister, you, us. We're all working together, the dietitian, nutritionist. We can make a difference on this particular topic.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for your question. Let's take our very next house call.
I've been using Donatol for my irritable bowel syndrome for over a decade. Recently, my new doctor said it's addictive and that I shouldn't take it. I've never had a problem with addiction, but I do take this every day to avoid pain. What do you think?
I think this is one of those situations where perhaps you're right and also perhaps your doctor is right. You could both be right here, but how you have to come to an agreement here is certainly something to be discussed. We should first say what actually Donatol is and why it is useful for many people for irritable bowel syndrome.
So Donatol has a combination of 4 different medicines in it. And there's one of them that I always say wrong, but it's phenobarbital, hyoscyamine.
You did good.
Never say it
That's
right.
That's good. That's good. It's got
atropine and scopolamine.
Atropine and scopolamine are not easy to say. And these 4 different drugs, some of which you could normally get over the counter, but to get this is by prescription because of the combination, including phenobarbital, which is used for seizures at high doses to prevent seizures.
And it is possible to get these medicines in single medicines where it wouldn't be the combination of all of these things. And it may be that just one of the medicines might help you with your symptoms. But I tell you, when I saw this, I'm like, well, if you've been taking it for 10 years and you don't feel hooked on it and it helps you and you're not having any bad side effects, then I think it's a reasonable conversation for you to have with your doctor of, hey, if this is working for me, could I continue on like this? Or could we just try to make slow modifications?
Your doctor could also be correct here because in certain people, this drug tends to be habit-forming. And so if you had any other elements of your history, abuse of alcohol, marijuana, cocaine, other prescription drugs like Xanax or Percocet, then that kind of raises red flags here. And perhaps you could get by with just the hyoscyamine or one of those drugs there.
Did I say it? Well stated.
Oh, good. I'm glad. That's a tough word. So you both can be right, but you're going to probably have to talk with each other to get on the same page.
Mm-hmm. And we're glad that there is something that helps you with your symptoms. So thank you for your question. That's complex.
Erica, what's our very last house call?
I'm 65 and have heart failure. You talk a lot on your show about exercise. I'm wondering if I can start running and train for a 10K road race, which is my goal. Is it safe?
Oh, I just say I am so glad you've got a goal for exercising at any age. And boy, what a great question about exercising and heart failure.
And, you know, most people say start slow. It's hard to know. I don't know what your exercise and conditioning level is at this point. Certainly, if you're already running and able to do those things, then going for a 10K road race may be very, very reasonable. If you are having trouble walking to the mailbox, it's also possible to reach that goal for sure, but you would need to start slow and really work yourself up to that kind of endurance and talk with your doctor about the safety and about the way to do that. I also would want to know more about your heart failure and how, you know, your current symptoms and your current medications about your heart failure now. And that's something that you could talk with your primary doctor about as well.
And I think talking, you know, this is one of those situations where you may have a cardiologist already. You know, could be a group decision here. And then also, you could get data here. You could have stress tests. You can have other things to say the safety of gradually working up and not only starting low but going slow here. Mm-hmm. But this, I would imagine, and we can probably try to find some research here that addresses this, get our health sciences librarians to help us post this literature here. I suspect that you can do it and can be done safely.
And we think there is some data showing that getting back into exercise and having heart rehabilitation can actually make your heart failure better and help you in a whole variety of ways. So we want to encourage you to start low, go slow, and work with your team.
That's right. Talk with your doctor. Well, that'll conclude our house calls today. Christy, we've had a chance to talk about a lot of things, including heart failure and running.
Measles vaccine.
Donatal and IBS.
And a link between Down syndrome and obesity.
Well, we hope everyone's enjoyed our show today. We've had a chance to talk about a variety of things. And if you have an issue you want us to address on an upcoming show, send it to us at yourhealth@unc.edu.
You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, follow us on Twitter, on Facebook, and get our shows on iTunes and get our health app.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for the sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Matthew Long. We hope you join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Presented by UNC Family Medicine.